This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk. Today I have the pleasure of talking to Caroline Leavitt about her new book, Pictures of You, published by Algonquin in 2011. Hi, Caroline. How are you?
Hi, Greg. How are you?
It's really good to talk to you. We first met talking about Girls in Trouble,
right,
which I read in 2010 and mm-hmm. really loved. And I couldn't wait to read this book. And, you know, we had talked a little bit about this when mm-hmm. we first spoke, because you had already written this book, I think, then.
Right.
It was waiting to be published. But maybe you could talk a little bit about this book. You know, the story is important, so we don't want to give anything away,
right.
But the broad scope of what it's about.
Well, every book for me starts with a question that haunts me, and for me this particular book was, how well do we really know the people that we love or that we have a relationship with? And I also base this book around a specific phobia of mine, which is driving. I've had my license since I was 16, but I haven't driven since I got my license. And my
biggest, you're lucky they renew it for you then without a test.
They don't make me drive. They just
right.
make me fill out the form. And, you know, I've been so phobic about it because I keep thinking, what if I get in a car crash? What if I kill somebody? And it got worse and worse when I had my son. So I wanted to center a novel around a car crash and sort of the colliding lives of four people around that crash, which includes Isabel, who's a photographer who's running away from her philandering husband. There's Charlie, a husband who's desperate to know what his wife and son were doing in a car 3 hours away from home. There's April, a wife and mother who has this terrible secret that you don't find out about until the end. And there's this character, Sam, who's this 9-year-old boy who has severe asthma, who has a secret of his own. And I just wanted to see how these lives would intersect and just sort of play it out. And that's how the book came about.
And, of course, the story is set in Cape Cod. They
yes.
all live
mm-hmm.
in the two people who have the accident live in the same town.
Mm-hmm.
But the accident occurs 3 hours away in,
right.
Connecticut near Hartford.
Right.
And which is kind of part of the, I think, you know, when you talk about a car accident, it's almost necessary to think about the literally accident.
Right.
You know, the sense that, you know, as people do always,
mm-hmm.
what if I had not left one instant later,
right.
or one instant before? You know, that here you have two people who
right.
leave their homes
mm-hmm.
and have this terrible
right.
intersection, literally,
right.
Away from home.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, Isabel, who was leaving, can't leave.
Right.
The guy she was married to obviously kind of feels bad, wants to take her back, but
right. she doesn't.
Smart enough to know, and she doesn't fall prey to his entreaties
right.
Because he's already taken up with another woman, and
mm-hmm.
she finds out that the other woman is pregnant,
right.
and of course she could not have children,
right.
therefore it's like just heartbreaking.
It's horrible.
Painful. And there's a lot of this very painful story in many ways. There's a lot of painful moments and a lot of pain,
mm-hmm.
ongoing pain for everybody involved.
Mm-hmm.
And these, you know, so what you do with this setup is then, and this is the part I thought that was complicated and that you handled really well, that Isabel then feels drawn almost
mm-hmm.
to, she needs to know what happened.
Right.
First of all, it starts out that no one will tell her. She's
right.
in the hospital, injured.
Right.
No one will tell her what happened to the other person.
Right.
And she, you know, you have that great scene where they come out of the fog and April's car is parked on the road, pointing in the wrong direction.
Right.
And you know that, we know that Isabel has killed her, but Isabel doesn't know.
Right.
And it takes a long time before anyone
mm-hmm.
will tell her. So there, it starts with that, you know, this her feeling of incompleteness. She
mm-hmm.
can't close the loop. So she's drawn then to, I think, you know, kind of
right.
almost like a magnet
mm-hmm.
to Charlie and the boy, Sam,
mm-hmm.
who is there.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, Sam is the witness to what happened, but he can't talk about it.
Right.
So this whole story unfolds, you know, and they're connected. And I thought the part, again, I started to say this, that you did a risky thing, I think, by connecting Isabel with the husband of the dead woman, mm-hmm. because you could easily fall into sentimentality there.
Right, right. I really was determined to avoid that. I don't like to tie things up very neatly, and I didn't want to. And I made it more that she's drawn to them not so much because, you know, she feels a love connection, but it's more that she's looking to atone, and she feels that if she knows that, well, they're as all right as they can be, maybe then she'll be able to leave the Cape and start her new life. And so
but
it's almost a selfish, yeah, she wants closure.
Yeah.
It almost begins as a very selfish act, and then as she gets to know them, her feelings deepen.
Right, and of course, that's the place where I thought was most complicated, is her relationship to Sam and Charlie.
Mm-hmm.
And she really, you have her more involved with the boy than with the father. And the father's complicated. I mean, he's like this really good guy on one level.
But on another level, he's not so great.
Right.
He has some issues.
One's perfect.
Right. He has some issues. But yeah, I would say that that's true, that her supreme relationship is with this boy. That's her great love.
And he's a kind of wounded soul.
Yeah.
But he's also physically wounded because he has asthma,
you know,
serious asthma.
Yeah.
And that, in fact, that's one of the complexities of the story also, is we find out that April was leaving the Cape without him, not knowing. And then you can, you know, kind of wonder what was going on, because she was really involved with her son. It's not like she was a bad mother.
Right.
She loved him, and she raised him. He's 9 years old. She spent 9 years going to the hospital with him.
Right.
You know, lying in bed with him. You paint her as really devoted.
Right.
So then you have this real deep question. It's like, why was she leaving without him? Where was she going? And you set her up as a kind of person who has some mysteries about her, because she had, she'll get in a car and drive.
Right.
Just for fun.
Right.
And so, you know, there's a mystery to be solved.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the mystery for her husband, which he becomes obsessed with, hires a private detective.
Right.
Doesn't get anywhere because there is nowhere to go.
There's nowhere to go.
And so anyway, as the story unfolds, and we don't want to give too much away, but Isabel and Charlie and Sam have a relationship, which is fraught. There's no way, other word to put on it.
Right.
So that's, you know, a long part of the middle of the book is about the relationship and what happens back and forth. And I thought, this is similar to Girls in Trouble. You like focusing on that, you know, a period, and then you come back to them. You know, you let time pass.
Right.
So in this story, the structure of it is, there's most of the book takes place in this present time.
Over the summer.
These events have happened. And then there's resolution, and then you come back.
Right.
And you kind of close the loop on them many years later. So that I think you've done that before.
Yeah, I'm very interested in the passage of time, because I think that things do stretch over time, and you can have a trauma as a child, and then all of a sudden it comes back in some form when you're in your 30s, and sometimes you don't get to resolve it until much, much later.
Right, which you have obviously for, ultimately, for Isabel.
Right.
And for Sam.
Mm-hmm.
That's the resolution is delayed.
Right.
I mean, they get on with their lives. I think that's a part of what you have as a common feature in your books. The characters go through these major emotional events, and you don't like to close the loop. You don't like to close the story right away. You're reflecting more what happens in real life, which is people do get over a trauma. They find a way of resolving, maybe not happily or successfully or completely, but for most people, wounds become scar tissue.
Right, exactly right.
And then they go on.
Exactly right. I like to, I always say that I like to disturb people's lives, but I don't want to ruin them. They're able to go on, but they still very much do have that scar tissue, and it lasts. They're still going to have those scars and those issues when they're 90 years old.
Right. Now, of course, to go back to the phobia that you mentioned, in this book, Isabel has the phobia.
Yes.
But she, she has to get over it at some point, and
right.
she does. And do you feel like by having her do that, you kind of helped solve a little of your own problem?
No, I wish that I could say that it did help me, but it actually didn't. I'm still completely phobic about driving. Every once in a while, I take a refresher course, and it's always the same, where the instructor will tell me, you're the worst driver I've ever had, or else he'll tell me, last time I was told, some people aren't meant to drive, and maybe you're one of them. And I wanted to give Isabel what I couldn't give myself. I mean, Isabel discovers that she wants to be one of these people who can conquer her fears. And one of the instructors says to her, my best students are the ones who are afraid. And she just determined that she's going to do that. But the difference between me and Isabel is she's very determined and she wants to drive, whereas I feel I'm in the New York City area. I don't have to drive. I don't have to put myself through this. So I still choose not to, and I still have my phobia, whereas she was able to, I gave her that gift.
Right. Well, and of course, I think it must be fun as a writer, especially of novels, where you can create characters and have them do things that are not necessarily things you'd want to do.
Right. Well, in every book, I always have characters who love to drive, and driving is always very, very important to them. Somebody's always driving off into the night, or they're running away in a car.
Maybe there's a little romanticism.
Yeah, I like that idea, and I can live through that in my writing, and it's something that I probably will never choose to do in my own life.
So do you think in this story, in this particular story, do you feel like, is this a story you're just going to be done with? Or are any of these guys coming back?
Oh, no. I mean, once I'm finished with the book, that's it. I mean, it's a really hard process to say goodbye because they feel so real. And the interesting thing is I've had people ask me, well, what happens after the book is over, because there's some things that are open up, and I just say, well, I don't really know. I mean, I'm with you. I don't know. I mean, these people are very real to me, but I don't really know where they're going to be in another 10 years. A lot of different things could happen. I just know where they are at that point when the book ends.
So in any particular of these characters that you feel, like, close to more than any others?
Yeah. You know what? I feel really close to Sam. Sam actually came about as a mistake. I knew I wanted to have a kid, but I didn't think that I wanted him to have asthma, because as a child, I was really, really sick myself with asthma. I don't have it now. I have it very, very mild, but as a kid, I was always in and out of hospitals and ERs, and he just appeared on the page, and I really didn't want to write about a kid with asthma because my childhood was so horrible and just so full of grief and shame. So I deleted all the files, and he kept coming back. And I know as a writer that sometimes what you want to be writing about isn't necessarily what you should be writing about. So I started to write him. And I started to give him my childhood with asthma, all the shame and all the problems and, being made fun of and all the issues with family. And the interesting thing is the more I started to write about him, the better I started to feel physically. So I would be writing passages where Sam was in an oxygen tent and critically ill, and I wasn't using any of my asthma medicine at all. So this went on for about 3 years, and I finally went to my doctor and said, I think I'm cured. And he said, ha, 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 there's no such thing. But I still kept feeling better right up until the day I turned the book in, and then I started to get sick again.
That's really funny. But, you actually have that in the book, of course.
Yeah.
Sam goes to his doctor and his father and says,
right.
I'm cured.
Right.
He has the same kind of, you've imbued him with that same story.
Right.
That he, of course, it's always, again, that's kind of a risky thing
mm-hmm.
to think about, that you can heal yourself, because the implication is
right,
if you're sick, then there's something wrong with you because
right.
you couldn't heal yourself.
Well, no. I mean, I obviously haven't healed myself, but what I did heal was my feelings of shame about having asthma and my grief. And the interesting thing about this is when I started to tell people, you know, the 4 years I wrote this, I didn't have asthma at all, the reactions were very different. I had one person who was the head of this big asthma association. She was really mad.
Right.
She was really mad. She said, you know what, that's horrible information to tell people. This is impossible. And you're doing
implies,
a disservice. You're
implying.
And I kept saying, I'm not really implying anything. I'm just saying that for me, for 4 years, I felt better. No, I didn't heal myself, but I felt better. And whether it's because I was more relaxed or whether it's because, you know, asthma is a tricky disease. It can get worse and get better. And who knows? Maybe the stars just aligned. But she was really infuriated with me. But I've had other people, like, you know, the Bellevue Hospital does this literary review, and they believe that when you create a narrative out of illness, it can help you feel better about your illness, and it can help you manage the symptoms. And certainly there is some relationship between cortisol levels when you're all stressed and tensed up with illness, especially asthma. So, I knew it was controversial then. And, you know, in the book, Sam gets better, but he's a child at the time, and a lot of asthmatics as children do grow out of it. So whether he himself feels that he did it or whether it's just natural biology, I never made a statement on which way it was. But
no,
it was,
but I can understand the concern that someone might have, but I think that you didn't imply that if you have asthma, you should ignore your symptoms, don't go to a doctor, and try to heal yourself.
You can't do that.
That would be unfair to you. Plus, it's a novel. It's fiction.
Right. It's fiction.
But I think it's important, you know, that reminds me of I think it was Norman Cousins who wrote extensively about the effect of joy and happiness laughter on your illness, that a positive outlook can help create a positive outcome. And so it's not completely off the wall for Sam to feel better about himself physically as he feels better about himself emotionally. So I thought that was really good. There were a couple other things about Sam that I was really interested in, and of course it relates to Isabel and the photography. She's a photographer.
Mm-hmm.
You have her in the book as a really good photographer who is not able, at least during most of her youth and early adulthood, she's not able to do anything with that. She's stuck in this town.
She's stuck.
She has a GED, no degree. She feels like she can't do it. But she loves teaching Sam how to be a photographer. And she really does stick with her commitment to get out of that town and make herself whole. She, in fact, heals herself in that way. Yes, the relationship with Sam and Charlie is important, but ultimately it's about her.
Right.
And what I liked that Sam loved photography so much, that kind of, I love your description of, you know, this kind of ability to use the camera to focus. And are you a photographer yourself?
Or? No, I'm not. I gave him photography because when I was really little, young, and asthmatic, the thing that really saved my life was writing stories. It was something, you know, when you're sick and your world is so narrow, to have something creative which can make you get out of that world is amazing. And I wanted Sam to have that where he could feel, you know what, I'm not just this kid with asthma. I can take pictures, and he could start to understand his mom's death through photography. And also he wasn't bullied because he could walk into school and he has this cool camera, and all the kids suddenly think, oh, he's not asthma boy anymore. He's this cool kid with a camera. And I just like the whole idea of, you know, that photography is a way of seeing things differently, and that includes your world.
So do you imagine in your own mind as you're writing, do you imagine the photographs themselves?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Each of them took. So you have kind of both different views, because you described Sam's pictures really visually. You obviously had to think of them yourself.
I had, when I was writing the book, I had photographs all over, you know, posted all over my wall of what I thought the characters looked like and what I thought the photographs looked like, so I could look at them and just make it that much more real.
Well, it's a very, you know, it is a really, the descriptives in the book or descriptive sections of the book are very vivid. And I was really taken with, I think it's hard to write about photography.
Right.
You know, the visual is hard to translate into the verbal. And some people can do it, other people can't.
Well, I did a lot of research. I talked to a lot of photographers, and then I showed them passages saying, does this work? Is this the way a photographer would look at something? And a lot of times they would say, nope, and I'd go back to the drawing board. But I wanted to be really careful that it was sort of, you know, inside a photographer's head.
So you told me, I think, about Girls in Trouble, that you rewrote that book over and over and over again.
At least 12 times. And
right.
This book I
How
must have... I would say, before I sent it to my agent, I wrote it about 8 times.
So are you an obsessive compulsive?
No, it just takes me... I am, but it takes me that long to get the story. Then my agent called me up and said, love the book, we have to do some work on it. And she made me rewrite it 5 times.
Wow.
Then she sold it to Algonquin in 2 weeks, and they said, love the book, but we have to do some work on it. And it was another 3 times.
And they wanted different things than the agent.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And,
but the thing is, that's the stage that I really love it, because that's the stage where you sort of have the story, and it's mostly like layering, changing things, and making things richer.
Make it richer and deeper.
Richer and deeper.
Yeah.
And, I mean, in the original drafts, actually, April was pretty unsympathetic. And my agent said, you know, you have to really, people are going to hate her and they're going to want her to die in this car crash. So I had to do a lot of work on her to change that around.
No, I think it is true that it's better that it's less black and white.
Right.
That their characters
right.
are all sympathetic. They're
right.
all real. They
right.
have issues.
Right.
They have strengths. They
right.
have weaknesses. That that's the way people are.
It is the way people are. Even a villain doesn't see himself as a villain.
Right.
I mean, you know, you can take Jeff. I'm sure Jeffrey Dahmer has some hats.
Maybe not. There are
okay,
people
look
who
at
are
Tony,
off the chart.
All right, we'll look at like somebody like Tony Soprano.
Right.
I mean, he loved his family.
Right, which is what...
Which is
right.
endearing.
No,
which
I know. I think the modern
right.
fiction and television and movies,
right.
we require complexity. We require,
right.
you know, like Jimmy Cagney
right.
is an anodyne,
right.
whereas, and, you know, maybe Tony Soprano would
right.
be a good comparative.
Right.
1935, yes, there's a certain amount of complexity, but really,
pretty much,
he's
either
a bad guy.
He's a bad guy.
And you need to know that he's a bad guy.
Right.
Whereas in 1999 or 2010...
It's much different.
Right.
It's much different. You just don't know. There's all those nuances.
I wonder if that'll change. You know, I wonder if art, you know, it reflects the times.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, we see things as complex.
Right.
Maybe, but human beings like to have black
mm-hmm.
and white, dualities, you know, good and bad. Maybe
right.
Again, you know, the simplistic
mm-hmm.
view of things will come back. I don't know.
I hope not.
But no, I thought the rewriting was worth it, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
But do you feel like is there a time when you just say, "That's it. I'm done. I don't want to do anymore because it's really finished"?
No. No, I always think I can do more, that I could have made things deeper and more and to enrich it. It's always really, really hard to give up a book, which is why I always try to have another book on the sidelines, because otherwise it's too hard. It's just, you know, it's too hard to give it up. It just feels terrible.
Right, so in a way for you, it's like you're entering this world.
Right.
You enter the world and you're writing from it,
mm-hmm.
not necessarily... writing the story from start to finish. In other words, it seems
right.
like for you, it's an inhabitance
right.
with
exactly.
the characters in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And you could leave it, you don't really want to leave it.
I don't want to.
But the
leave
world,
it.
But because we live in a world that requires a finished good,
right?
Right, you have to leave. Now, theoretically, that means you would be perfect for writing interactive fiction, you know, a kind of world where you could write digitally. You know,
mm-hmm.
you write the story, publish it electronically so people could read it while you were writing, but literally you would never have to finish the story. You could just keep on going forever.
Right. Well, that's always the goal, but the publishers don't like that.
Right. No, I know, because, again, it's right. The book is a finished good. It's right. a commodity that right. has to be enclosed. But I think in the digital world, mm-hmm. it kind of opens this up. And most writers are really not suited for that. I think many writers like the idea, I want to start it and finish it, I want mm-hmm. to move on to the next thing,
right.
but your style seems almost more accustomed to digital publishing.
Yeah, I think so.
So what's the next book?
Well, I sold my next book to Algonquin, and I have only a year left to finish it, so I'm really under the gun. It's set in the late 1950s and the early 60s, and a lot of it revolves around a suburban Cold War paranoia. And it's a mystery in this suburb, and the main character is this divorced woman with a son. And of course, in the late 50s, it was horrible to be divorced, and it was horrible to be a single woman and to have a job, and she's very suspect, and there's a crime that happens in the neighborhood, and because she's different and there's all this paranoia, she's sort of targeted. And, you know, the book is a lot about how do we trust people, how do we keep safe, and what's the difference between imagined threats, you know, like the Cold War and communists everywhere, and real threats that usually come from within.
People we know.
Somebody mentioned it was like that. I don't know if you ever watched The Twilight Zone.
Yes.
But there's this very famous episode, I think it's called The Monsters Have Come to Maple Street. It's about this suburban,
yes.
neighborhood, and they think that there might be a space alien in the mist, and they're not sure, and they start turning on each other. And at the end, you see all the space aliens saying, we don't have to do a thing. They're just, you know, do it themselves. So it's sort of that kind of idea.
Right. Well, no, it's an interesting period.
That's a fascinating period.
Of course,
period.
I grew up in that period, and, you know, it was not necessarily an enjoyable period, especially the not only the Cold War paranoia, but the fear of the fear of nuclear mm-hmm. holocaust. I mean, somebody mentioned this the other day. I forget where I saw this, but he had somebody, I saw it, I think it was a show on TV. He had interviewed JFK, and it was the day of the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Mm-hmm.
And he was sitting in the office waiting for Kennedy. Oh, I know what it was. It was a film about artists mm-hmm. in Westport, Connecticut, which is where I'm from, more or less, filming older artists in their current life, talking about, and one of the guys that they interviewed said this was one of his great moments. He had gone to take photographs, and Kennedy, he was talking about that moment, that day of, you know, where really throughout America, we all thought we were going to die.
Right.
And when you're, you know, it kind of heightens the awareness. But I think people were not self-aware. So, you know, I think writing about that period novelistically is really good.
It's really, the research is fascinating. I found pamphlets that, actually one was written by Bugs Bunny, explains nuclear war to you. And they had tips like, you know, in the event of a nuclear bomb, just make sure to wipe your feet before you go inside so you won't track in radiation.
Right.
All the duck and cover drills.
Yeah, we did that in school. I remember.
I remember duck and cover
going
too.
Going underneath the desk, it was going to save your life.
And just this, you know, the guy across the street from me when I was growing up built a bomb shelter in his driveway. When you think about it,
a lot of people built bomb shelters and put food in them, and then would have to go down there and take the food out and put in new food.
Right, because it would rot.
Right. I mean, even canned goods go expire, and people were really thinking about that on a daily basis.
Right,
and of course there were the missile silos
right.
Throughout America, where there were soldiers an Air Force, members of the Air Force stationed, who were prepared to close the doors, set off their missiles, and then survive whatever came after. So there was this, it's almost surreal to think about
that. It was surreal. It was totally surreal because you're living with it, but then, so the message is you can die, but, you know, if you wipe your feet, you'll be okay. So it's sort of like, or if you have a fall, you know, this flimsy little fallout shelter, you'll be all right, you'll survive, which of course nobody would have survived if there was a real one.
But at the same time, as you're maybe suggesting in your story, you know, people lived their lives.
Mm-hmm. They did.
Life was going on, mm-hmm. you know, despite the fact that the Cuban Missile Crisis was happening. I went to school
right.
every day.
Right.
You know, people did their businesses. You know, people traveled. Everything continued on. And so what it shows you is that we can actually absorb
right.
a lot
right.
of angst. But it clearly had, it did have effects on people. And I think, mm-hmm. you know, I think that's a good subject for a story. I'll be looking forward to reading that after you've rewritten it seven or eight times,
right.
Well, thanks so much, Caroline. It's been great talking to you once again.
Thank you very much.
It's always a pleasure. And I really enjoy pictures of you, your
Thank
new book.
You.
And I'm hopeful that others will agree.
Thank you so, so much.
This has been Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm David Wilk, your host. I've been talking to Caroline Levitt, the author of Pictures of You.